On Valentine's Day in 1991, a young woman is seen hitchhiking along US 1 in the Florida Keys. The next day, a pair of windsurfers find her body in a densely wooded area. She'd been beaten to death before being strangled with her own bikini top. For years, this young woman was known only as Valentine Jane Doe, named for the last day she was seen alive. But investigators never give up on her case, utilizing new tactics and techniques to help identify her. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes by Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Patricia Ray.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
We've been actually covering quite a few cases that have been solved, which is weird for a podcast like ours. How do you feel about that?
I think it's nice being able to, like, actually not leave it such a mystery.
Yeah, like, some people really like the resolution, right?
Right.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I like is that we're able to highlight how those cases were solved so that hopefully more people are willing to, like, submit their DNA places for that kind of identification.
So this is going to be another DNA solve?
Yes.
See, so that's, yeah, I think it's fun to be able to share that with everybody and, like, how effective that is. And we've talked about, like, giving permission to GEDmatch before to use, like, your online genealogy stuff, so.
Yeah, so, like, your DNA gets used to build these, like, family trees and connections.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, this is one that I, you know, back when I wrote a poem for her, like, I did not anticipate this being solved at all.
So it's a nice surprise.
It is. And so, you know, this is a story that I knew as an unidentified woman's story. And so the poem at the end reflects that. And today we're going to talk about how she was identified and the whole process and what we know about her as a person.
Okay, so are we going to go back to the story of that you based the poem off of first before we get into that?
Yeah, so we're going to start with her being found, progress all the way up to where we are now with her story.
Sure, sounds good.
So this story is about a woman who was murdered on Valentine's Day. And I spent years sharing her story on that date. And we actually had the opportunity to make this episode coincide with that date this year, but I actually wanted to emphasize her story outside of that instead of continuing to mark that anniversary.
Really? Because Valentine's Day has nothing significant for her her life, right? Except for
the day she was murdered.
Right. Yeah. Not a great.
No.
No. So I think it's fine that we're doing it this way.
Right. So, like, to honor her and talk about her story, like, disconnected with that, finally. Right. So let's start with her story. It's around 8 in the morning on February 15th, 1991, and some windsurfers were walking near an area known to locals as the Horseshoe. This is an area in the Florida Keys that's east of Big Pine Key and west of Bahai Honda Key. And from what I've learned, because there's really only one road in and out of the Florida Keys, residents pay much more attention to mile markers than I would have presumed. And so this is near mile marker 35 on Highway 1. It's a pretty densely wooded area that was often used for illegal camping.
So they actually pay attention to the mile markers?
Yeah.
I've been on that road, like, as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
We've driven to Key West.
Yeah.
And it really is just like this one
road. Yeah.
So, but I don't really remember much of what it looked like or the mile marker thing.
Yeah. So I think, like, locals do, because, like, that's, like, much more how you tell people where to go, which isn't necessarily the case in New York, where I couldn't tell you what mile marker I even live near.
Right.
So these windsurfers, they're walking along a ravine area, and one of them sees a body, and he calls his friend over to confirm what he's seeing. And this wooded area is the nude body of a person, and they can't quite see, but because the person is face down, they initially assume that it's a man. Their call to the Monroe County Sheriff comes in around at 8:15 a.m., And when investigators arrive, they know immediately that there is blood by the main road. On a dirt road leading off of it, there are also drag marks in the dirt, indicating that the body of this person had been dragged to that location. And that's where they find the body of not a man, but a woman. She's face down and her head is in a small pool of water. The woman has been badly beaten, particularly around the face and head. There's also smaller abrasions on the rest of her body, and investigators say it was clear that she was attacked and that she had fought back.
Is there any reason why those guys assumed that she was a man?
I think they just, like, couldn't see very well. I don't know if they really wanted to approach to investigate further. They just saw a body that was face down.
I don't blame them.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to get too close either.
Yeah, I mean, that had to be...
You wouldn't want to ruin anything around it either.
Right, and it's, like, probably a pretty shocking situation. So, thankfully, you know, that's resolved pretty quickly.
Okay.
So, as they're assessing what happened to her, there's clear marks around her neck as though she's been strangled with something. They believe her assailant did this with her bikini top. The rest of her clothing is nearby, and they collect what is often referred to as a red and purple cardigan, although it has always looked to me as purple and pink. Knee-length denim shorts, some moccasin-styled black shoes with red stitching and fringe on the back. Other than that, there really isn't necessarily much evidence at the scene, and she's doesn't have her ID on her either. Her autopsy is able to yield a few more clues, though. She has ear piercings, 4 in each ear, and her left ear are 2 non-matching earrings. One was a silver ball, and one was like a white faux pearl. In her right, again, all the earrings didn't match, but she had all 4 in. More notably, though, she had 2 tattoos. On the back of her left hand, in kind of the webbing area, she had a small cross tattoo that had lines radiating from it like sun or light rays, and on the back of her left shoulder, she had a heart tattoo with the word love written inside.
So it is a little strange that she has, like, I mean, it's absolutely no, it's just a coincidence, but the heart with the word love inside of it, and she was killed on Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I mean, this is, like, something that I think propels her case into, you know, one that is publicly more recognizable because, like, that is, like, an odd coincidence. This coincidence is, you know, both the Valentine's Day and the tattoo. She ends up being known as Valentine Doe.
Okay.
They estimate that she's between the ages of 16 and 25 years old and somewhere between 5'4 and 5'7, and that she weighs approximately 135 pounds. She had brown hair and brown or green eyes. Of note, she has ovarian and fallopian tube cysts, as well as chronic salpingitis. Salpingitis is basically a type of pelvic inflammatory disease that causes the inflammation of the fallopian tubes. This is caused by bacteria, which is usually sexually transmitted. When it's chronic, like her condition, it can sometimes go unrecognized because the person might not feel pain or discomfort. But the medical examiner believed that with all of these things combined, the cysts, the salpingitis, that she was likely experiencing abdominal pain.
And that's like quite an age range too, 16 to 25.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People don't realize like how inexact that science is.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you feel like it should just be like.
You always guess that it would just be a little bit, maybe just like maybe within a 5-year range. But.
Yeah. I mean, I also find often like the height measurements, like she was recently murdered and, you know, it's anywhere between 5'3 and 5'7.
Like, yeah, it's significant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One other thing they know is that her teeth are well cared for and straight, and she only has one filling, and it looks like a molar was removed around the time she was 10 based on the amount of healing, I'm guessing. Assessing her further, the examiner noted that she did not have tan lines, and that she did have stretch marks. These stretch marks seem to be like the biggest piece of evidence the medical examiner uses to suggest that it's possible that she had carried a child to full term.
Okay, but she could have had those stretch marks from like
anything,
like rapid weight gain, rapid weight loss. There's like other things, growth.
Right, and some people are much more subject to stretch lines than others, so.
Yeah, we don't know that it's from that.
Yeah, so that's his determination, though.
Okay.
But, like, that assumption about the possibility of a pregnancy, like, transforms over time. So it goes from, much, you know, it's possible that she was pregnant to, like, later people start saying with absolute certainty that she had a baby somewhere. Now, they determine it was likely she was murdered on February 14th, and though it's not fully conclusive, there's a strong likelihood that she was sexually assaulted. And again, later they start saying with much more certainty that she had absolutely been sexually assaulted, but in the initial reports, it seems much more vague than that.
I think them saying something like that and trying and always saying that she was sexually assaulted, it doesn't really have much on finding her or on the case. But like saying that she is somebody who had a baby, if your loved one is missing but they've never been pregnant before, right away you're going to see, oh, okay, it's not her.
Right.
So I don't need to contact the police.
Yeah. Or, you know, there's a lot of sort of amateur sleuths who investigate these cases. And so, you know, they also... You know, we're thinking this person or maybe not this person based on that information that was pushed forward.
Right.
I mean, thankfully, there was a lot of conversation, at least in the message boards and places that I saw when people were talking about her case, that like particularly a lot of women were chiming in to be like, you could get stretch marks from other things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So even with all of this information, they're not any closer to identifying who she is. She's not a match for any local missing persons cases, and no one is coming forward to claim her. Investigators start piecing together the clues, and some notable things to them are the lack of tan lines. They reasoned that most locals, or even people who had been in Florida for a bit, would have evidence of sun exposure. They also noted that her cardigan was outside the norm, even in February for that time of year. Like, I don't know about you, Vanessa, but I am notoriously cold all the time. And even when I am in warmer environments, I'll often find myself putting on a sweater. So even when I lived in Arizona, if it dipped below 70 degrees, like I was bundled up. So I checked the weather in this part of Florida. That day in 1991, it was a low of 72 with a high of 79. So I can see why they would draw that conclusion. But the day before, February 13th, was in the mid 60s.
She could have just had the sweater with her for nighttime, too.
Right?
Because like, sometimes the difference between daytime and nighttime, it is a big enough difference that you might like, want a sweater.
Feel chilled.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can see where they were going with all this, like the tan lines and the sweater. But like again, like those don't really seem very definitive for me. They added in her shoes as well because they felt like it was more likely that a Florida resident would be wearing sandals or sneakers.
I feel like that's a stretch.
Right.
Like, maybe it is, but also maybe it's not. We don't know this girl's personal style.
Yeah.
It could be anything.
I mean, the amount of times that I have worn sandals in the snow, despite being a person who's always cold, is ridiculous.
Well, now they would think that if they found you, you came from a warmer place.
Right.
You just said a minute ago, too, that you were always cold.
I know.
And now you're telling me you wear sandals in the winter?
Not now, but in my misspent youth, yes. Active rebellion. Sandals in the snow. I mean, thank God I did not get frostbite. But so running on barely any leads, investigators start questioning people and even set up roadblocks to facilitate this. What they get is a few more pieces of information. Witnesses say they saw her walking, potentially hitchhiking, heading north on Highway 1 on Valentine's Day. She was seen at mile markers 10 and 14 and at around 6:30 p.m. at mile marker 17. Now, she was found at mile marker 35, which means she was found roughly 18 miles from where she was last seen. It's likely then that someone picked her up sometime after 6:30 p.m. Witnesses also said that they had spotted an older model white pickup truck with a shell camper on the back. It was driven by two men, and witnesses say they spotted it in the days before her disappearance.
Why are they taking note of this?
I really feel like the people maybe of Key West were particularly nosy. I mean, like, we live in a small area, which we emphasize a lot, and I'm not sure.
Like, I would never be just like, I saw a weird blue car. Like, right. I can't assume that I know every single car around here. Are they... Is that what they're saying?
Yeah.
So they know every single vehicle in that area.
Yeah. So like basically that this truck had been seen in the area in the days before and this was noteworthy.
Okay. They didn't even see a girl in it.
No. It was just that the truck was in the
Okay. It took me a minute when you first said that to like connect the dots on this. Like, why are we reporting this?
Right.
Will this become useful later?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like this is an investigation in which they had just so little to go on that, like, they're just, like, trying to pull together, like, whatever they could. And,
well, it's a camper. It could be just, like, two guys out camping.
I know.
Like, going on vacation, driving down there. Oh, my gosh. Okay.
Okay.
Carry on.
Okay. So, nothing comes of this. As we've established. So this is how she ends up being known. Sometimes she's known as Florida Jane Doe, but Valentine Jane Doe becomes the name she's most recognized with. I think that's largely, you know, the striking details of her case, like I said, that solidify this. Investigators started circulating a sketch of her because her face was so badly beaten, they didn't want to share photos of her. And over the years, they updated these images of her pretty regularly. Investigators kept on digging, and eventually her file ballooned to over 4,000 pages long. She was even featured on Unsolved Mysteries, but the years kept passing by and no one came forward who recognized her, and they weren't any closer to solving her murder. This case, though, Valentine Jane Doe's case, weighs heavily on investigators. Lieutenant Manuel Cuervo said, "You wake up in the middle of the night and you're like, did we look at this? Who is she? Is there anything that we missed in looking at the evidence?" And like I said before, there are actually people who care about her. There were message boards filled with people scouring missing persons reports, trying to find a match for her. And I wasn't the only one sharing her image every Valentine's Day. Debbie Shepherd, who had worked in the communications department of the Monroe Sheriff's Office for 25 years before becoming a victim advocate, still thought of Valentine's Jane Doe, and she shared the composites done of her just like I was. Debbie told reporters that her case became personal for me. I spent many hours trying to identify her. But one day in 2020, Debbie was watching a show where they were talking about a case solved through investigative genetic genealogy. And when she was done, she immediately called Sheriff Ramsey at the Monroe Sheriff's Office and asked him if the same thing could be done for Valentine Jane Doe. But Sheriff Ramsey said something that likely shocked Debbie. He said that they had already done it and they had just found out the results, but he couldn't share that information with her yet.
That's crazy. So they were putting it together at the same time that she sees this. It's just like such a coincidence there too.
Right. So like they heard about it, they were on it, and like she heard about it and she was like, this is a case that we could use this on.
That's a great shock for Debbie. Like,
right.
If like, you're going to be shocked by something, at least it's good news.
Yeah. That she had then, you know, sharing her image, and then she knew at least that this was going to be resolved and that her family would find out. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, huge kudos to Monroe County for this. 2020 was still early for adopting an investigative genetic genealogy route. And it's something that other agencies are still resisting, like, 4 years later. But Monroe says that they want to stay current with new technologies and investigative practices.
We'll be back in a moment.
So what Monroe County did to make this happen is they worked with other agencies. First, they worked with Lori Napolitano, who at the time was the chief of the Orlando Regional Crime Laboratory with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And they also worked with CeCe Moore, who is part of Parabon Nanolabs. What they ended up doing is splitting this case into two parts. Lori would work on identifying Valentine Jane Doe, and CeCe would work on identifying Valentine Jane Doe's killer.
Is that typical to, like, divide it up like that?
Yeah. So what happens is, like, we are still in some gray areas here with what different companies and organizations and agencies are able to do or willing to do. I think there's lots of ethical concerns or processes. And so sometimes it's looked at as an unidentified body is one thing, using it in, like, a law enforcement case to move towards capturing a killer and then eventually proceeding to conviction. That's a different side of things. So I think, yeah, so sometimes they split it up. Like, we just did the last unidentified victims of the Green River Killer, and all three cases were handled by different organizations. So even that one, it was all unidentified cases.
Probably makes it so much easier for the person doing the investigating to have one thing to focus on.
Right. So, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting process, and it's interesting that they divided it up this way. Which means, though, on June 15th, 2020, the Monroe County Sheriff's Office was able to announce the results of Lori and Cece's work. And that's why, 29 years after Valentine Jane Doe was found, they were able to give her name back.
We're going to talk about who she was?
We are, but first, I'm going to talk a little bit about her killer because I don't want to emphasize him too much.
Okay.
First, Valentine Jane Doe was killed by a man. Unfortunately, that man will never face a trial for this murder because he was actually murdered himself on April 17th or 18th, 1992.
Pretty soon after.
Yeah, it's a little over a year after Valentine Jane Doe was killed. He was found in a ditch by three passersby on the J.T. Ottinger Road in Westlake, Texas. This place he'd been staying was just a mile or two from where his body was found. He was killed by several gunshot wounds to the head. Investigators were actually able to place him in Miami, Florida in late November 1990 because of a receipt that had placed him at a homeless shelter there that was actually on him when he was killed. Now, when this man was murdered in 1992, I doubt that receipt meant much, but it certainly helped place him in Florida close to the time that Valentine Jane Doe was murdered. At the time of his murder, his blood was placed on a bloodstain card, and this was later used to confirm his match as a killer to Valentine Jane Doe.
Okay, I'm sure most people know what this is. What's a bloodstain card?
It's just like a little card that they're able to put like a blood sample on that can be used later for testing.
So that's for DNA?
Yeah, at the time, like, you know, 1990s, we're probably talking more about like blood type.
Okay. Just seems weird. It seems like I would be picturing like vials, not like,
right, like
a card.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sometimes there's vials, sometimes there's card, but yeah, so his was a bloodstain card, which usually was, you know, blood type and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So DNA developed quite a bit in terms of identification since that time.
Yeah.
Now, like, I don't typically go around digging much in killers' histories, but I will say that investigators think it's likely this was not his first crime against women. One of the investigators mentioned a 1988 case out of California where he was accused of assaulting a woman. His murder case, though, who murdered him, is actually also currently unsolved. And that brings us to the most important part of the story, the identification of Valentine Jane Doe. Valentine Jane Doe was and is Wanda Kirkham. Wanda was born on January 11th, 1973. Wanda's mom was from California, and the mom moved to New York and married a man there. And Wanda was born in Hornell, New York, and her family moved around a bit in that region of New York, including the town of Pavilion. So if you're trying to place this on a map, because I had actually not heard of these towns as a New Yorker, this is geographically in the western New York part between Rochester and Buffalo. When Lori Napolitano was able to find a close match to Wanda, it was a maternal aunt who lived in California. It sounds like Wanda's mother was largely estranged from her family, and this aunt didn't know much about Wanda. In fact, she said something along the lines of, "I think there was a daughter."
Really? She didn't know that she even had a daughter?
Yeah, there's like some recognition, it seemed, that her sister had a kid, but
okay. Yeah.
And eventually, investigators were able to track down Wanda's cousin, Brenda, who had grown up with Wanda. So, according to Brenda, Wanda's parents had been abusive. Brenda told reporters, "I was the only cousin who would play with her and spend the night. I didn't see much of her. She kept to herself, and when her parents would come to my house, she would stay in the car with her mother."
So she was just a quiet kid.
Well, I get the impression what Brenda is trying to say is that, like, the dad would come in and visit, and, like, the mom and the kid would be forced to stay in the car.
Oh, they were, okay.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just her keeping to herself.
No.
It's her being forced to keep to herself.
Yes. And so it sounds like even Brenda, this close relative, really had limited contact with Wanda. Now, Wanda was never reported missing by her parents, and it sounds like this information was also kept from family members as well. Brenda said, "No one in the family knew when she left, and no one is sure how she got to Florida. She was 16 and had never been out in the world, and we had lost touch."
So was she 16 at the time of her murder?
No, 18.
Okay. 18. So she left at 16?
It sounds like it, but she can't pinpoint necessarily the precise date.
So this girl was just kind of just lost. Yeah. Before she was lost, almost.
Yeah.
It's just very sad.
It is incredibly sad. You know, Brenda says that when Wanda's father was asked specifically and directly about this, he would just claim that Wanda ran off with a man and was living in Elba, which is a town roughly 30 minutes away from Pavilion, New York. It does seem that as Wanda's mother was dying, there were some attempts to locate her, but obviously that didn't come to fruition. Both of Wanda's parents have since passed away. Now, because of that possible full-term pregnancy that was leaned on as this detail about her, I will say there doesn't seem to be any indication that that was true. In 2016, when Lieutenant Manuel Cuervo was interviewed about Wanda, he said that he had wanted her identified because, in his words, "We want to bring her remains home to someone who really cares and loves her."
But that was hard, right? Considering her situation?
Yeah, and a lot harder than they initially thought. Sometimes unidentified individuals are buried in the community that they're found, but Wanda's remains have been kept in storage this entire time. And so this opened up a question of what would happen to those remains now. Wanda's parents were no longer alive, and it sounds like they had a fraught relationship in the first place. And the closest relative was the maternal aunt in California, and she declined to accept Wanda's remains for burial.
I don't think I could do that.
Yeah.
I think I would accept them.
Yeah, I don't get the thought process there, but also I'm not part of that family or understand what might be going on, but...
But whatever did go on, she's a child and yeah. She has no one else who can claim her.
Mm-hmm. And so Debbie Shepherd, the woman who had been sharing Wanda's story for years, was set to accept her remains if no one stepped forward. But she was put in touch with Wanda's cousin, Brenda. Like, one of the reasons the aunt might have not accepted the remains is that there are burial costs, right? So it's also a financial consideration.
Is there any way to help somebody with something like that, though? There must be ways to either raise money or find a different way to deal with that, right?
To facilitate that, yeah. Right. So thankfully, like, Debbie's
the hero of the story.
Sort of like in love with Debbie. Debbie recognized that there were these financial burdens associated with this. And so she started a GoFundMe for Brenda, the cousin.
There you go. See?
Yeah.
She solved this.
She's on it. In the GoFundMe, she wrote, "Brenda is the only family member who cares, the only family member who ever tried finding her cousin, and the only family member who wants her cousin to have a final resting place. A place close by where Brenda and her family can pay their respects and mourn the loss of a cousin who ran away from home so she could be safe and was subsequently murdered." And Brenda herself said, "She went for so long without a name that I feel I want to give her name back with a proper burial place and a proper headstone. I want a headstone so everyone can see it." Thankfully, Oakley Monuments in Batavia stepped forward and offered a headstone for Wanda. And Wanda is now buried in central New York where, as Debbie Shepherd said, her family who cares about her can visit her grave and honor her memory.
That's really nice how, like, all these people, like these strangers, got together and made this possible.
Yeah, that there were, in her death, that there was so many people carrying her story and carrying this case, like the investigators, Debbie, right? Brenda, who just like never knew what happened to her cousin. People on message boards, like, yeah, trying to figure it out. And like all those people on message boards, like submitting case after case. One of the cases they submitted pretty regularly is actually going to be another missing person that we'll be talking about.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But like she had never been reported missing, so there was no file for her.
That is always like baffling to me too. Like, how do you not report someone missing?
Yeah.
But I guess, well, in this case, it seems like they just, same story, right? They take her as a runaway and don't try to find her.
Yeah. Like, I mean, you know, in this case, you know, investigators weren't even aware.
Right.
So, you know, we've talked about other stories where it's an investigator is kind of putting it off, but this is like the family just She's gone.
Didn't even give it a chance to get investigated.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, you know, when family members, the most they could do is kind of ask. The friend is asking the dad, like, what happened? And she's getting this story, right?
Yeah.
So this story is quite a bit different than other solved cases we've talked about before, since, like, Wanda has been identified. Her killer has been identified. And that means a lot of the loose ends have been tied up in this case. Like, we've had other stories where they've identified the woman but are still looking for her killer. We've also have ones where they've identified the killer but they're still trying to identify the woman. So
yeah, I guess I do have a question in that is, like, did they ever end up determining if she knew the killer?
It doesn't seem so. I think that the likely scenario that was worked out is that she was hitchhiking, right? I'm actually also wondering, like, she didn't have, they didn't find on her any belongings. So I don't know if she had, like, a backpack or bags or anything. But so she was hitchhiking. It is likely that this man simply intersected her path.
Wrong place, wrong time. Like,
yeah. And, like, yeah, likely picked her up while she was hitchhiking and murdered her. It sounds like he has this criminal history where he's assaulted women in the past. Yeah. So I think that's the likely scenario of what happened. So the real question in this case, and I think that there's this chance for other people to step forward and share what they knew of Wanda. Wanda moved around a bit when she was living at home in New York, so it seems likely that there may not be too many people who remember her well from, like, middle school or high school. But this seems to have been, like, a tough time for her, and so adding context to who she was and what happened to her, right? And if this timeline is correct, Wanda left home around the age of 15 or 16. Is it possible that someone knows something more about her from that time? So what, for instance, brought her to Florida, where she was hitchhiking, but without her personal belongings? Like, who knew her between the time that she left home and the time that she was murdered? So as her cousin Brenda said to reporters, she was murdered down there, and I didn't want her burial down there. My main goal was to give her her name back and a proper headstone. And I still think she had help getting to Florida. And if there is anyone still around who helped her or who knows anything, please contact us so we have an idea of what happened and why. There really doesn't seem to be a whole lot of love in Wanda's life, which means that Brenda is the one carrying her story forward. So my plea for people is that if you encountered Wanda during her life, please share that information so that her family member can know what happened to her.
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, Valentine, read by Patricia Ray. Patricia is a dynamic Latin American actress and producer born and raised in New York City, currently based in LA. She got her big break in the cult classic Swim Fan and starred in a major supporting role in the film Maria Full of Grace. The bilingual talent recurred on All Rise for 3 seasons as the powerful and sassy Judge Delgado. Her long list of television credits include NCIS Los Angeles, Blue Bloods, The Mentalist, and Chuck. Another notable performance was her hilarious portrayal of the character Madonna in the 2013 star-studded The Big Wedding. She is currently co-hosting the entertaining and controversial podcast Believe This on Spotify with Chris Crimey, from the Scientology Survivors podcast, Come Get Some. Patricia also produces the cooking segments, Cooking with Patty, that can be viewed on Instagram and her YouTube channel, Cooking Up Patty.
Valentine. Unidentified woman discovered February 15th, 1991 in Big Coppet Key, Florida. I lost time among the saints. The lark, the dove, the sparrow singing, the rush of ocean against sand. The men whisper the blackbird's cry, an echo against our blindness. The lot was cast, and then I drew. We move across the sky's circumference, the whistle down bend of touch me nots. On the shoulders of sand so far distant, from my hand etched to your pulse, and fortune said, "It should be you." Those men with arms like soldiers. In another life, they would bring miracles.